TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Professor Peter Wadams, The Politics of Climate Change, Farewell to Ice. This program is being produced in Mendocino County at the beginning of September 2018, only 16 miles east of where the largest wildfire in California history is slowly coming under control. Professor Peter Wadams is the UK's most experienced sea ice scientist and was professor of ocean physics at Cambridge from 1992 to 2015. He says that fossil fuel emissions caused the reduction of Arctic ice. Now the Arctic, in turn, is accelerating global warming instead of cooling the planet. The Arctic ice sheet covered the top of the world and touched the coasts of Greenland, Canada, Alaska, and Siberia for 100,000 years. In only 30 years, the retreat from the coastlines during the Arctic summer accelerated, and an ice-free Arctic in September may occur by 2020. And the Arctic winter is no longer cold enough to restore ice levels. At the end of August 2018, Peter Wadams was interviewed on the Reality Report blog produced by Paul McGinley and Brian Weinstein. And you can watch the whole conversation on YouTube. Here are excerpts on the politics of climate change, the East Siberian Arctic Shelf, blue water events, methane pulses, sea ice loss, extreme weather events, and the deflection of the great global air current, the jet stream, and the attitude of some political leaders. Here's the Reality Report.
You've spent, what is it, something like 30 trips to the Arctic, is that?
It was 53 at the last count.
53. Can you give us a little background of that?
Well, I've really been doing it for my whole working life, and I'm definitely a field scientist. I go out and measure things.
What would you say is the greatest concern right now?
Well, at the moment, it's really the speed at which it's retreating. And a lot of scientists who've never been up there sort of say this is happening far faster than any of us expected, which is completely untrue because it's the any of us. In fact, I'm saying this because I've just read it in a paper that's just out about the ice north of Greenland retreating. Various scientists have said this is faster than any of us expected. But in fact, it's not, because people who study the Arctic already know that this is the rate at which the retreat is happening. And with it happening at this rate, the ice will be gone pretty soon. Certainly in summer, the ice will be gone in maybe two or three more years. And then the winter ice will be retreating from then on. So it's the speed of the retreat, and that then has a whole set of impacts on global climate, because the loss of ice means that the albedo of the planet decreases. That is, there's more radiation absorbed. You're getting possibility of big releases of methane from the seabed, which, because the water in the Arctic is no longer as frigid as it was, and we're getting an increase in the rate of sea level rise because the Greenland ice sheet is warming up because the water around it isn't frozen anymore. So all the changes that are happening with the retreat of sea ice are having feedbacks on the climate, which are all nasty ones. Mm-hmm. They're accelerating various aspects of global change. And so the changes are not affecting just the Arctic, they're affecting the whole planet.
Well, we've got a kind of pincer movement going here, wouldn't you say, of rising waters and rising terrestrial temperatures. Which would you say is the greater immediate threat of the two?
Well, I think the immediate threat is the air temperature rise, which is giving the sea ice retreat, and the consequences that flow from that, which potentially could include a big methane pulse. But the longer term problem, and the one that's harder to deal with, is sea level rise. Because people tend to associate the two. They sort of say, well, if we can beat warming in some way by taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere or reducing our emissions, then we've got sea level beaten as well, but we haven't. As sea level rise, it comes from the melt of the ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica, and that's a very slow process. It is very much slower to turn it around. It's a bit like you're driving a kind of gigantic super tanker and you want to turn around to pick up somebody from a rowing boat. You have to go on for miles and miles. So the sea level rise seems to operate more or less independently of air temperature. We're warming, but even if we slowed the warming, the sea level rise would continue to accelerate, and that will then result in inundation of coastal cities, loss of lots of land, coastal land.
Yeah, it'd be a big economic hit. I think you on one of your videos, you mentioned something like a $60 trillion, something along those lines.
There wouldn't be dollars left anymore if that happened. But yeah, it would be 60 trillion was the estimate if there was a big methane pulse.
Speaking of this methane pulse, I mean, nobody really knows exactly how much methane is down there, right? I mean, Sokova and team have estimated something between, I think it was a broad range, 50 gigatons to something like 800 gigatons. I mean, that's quite a range. We don't really know, do we?
No, well, what they estimate, and that's based on many years of work and a lot of drilling and coring, is that there's 800 gigatons there. And this 50 gigatons figure that they've mentioned and that we've worked with is the assumption that maybe only 8% of it will be released in a short time, because as the protective layer of permafrost melts, you start working your way down through the sediments. And if you think about the first 8%, that's 50 gigatons, which itself is gigantic. And because in the end, the 800 will all go. But it is an estimate based on the best geology they can do. What's annoying is that we're all set to do a lot with working with them to do a big field operation in the East Siberian Sea to actually measure this. Because at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography, La Jolla, they have an instrument that you can tow behind a ship, electromagnetic instrument, which actually measures the density of the sediments, or the quantity of methane in sediments subsurface. And so we want to take that out and do some other things as well. And the problem has been to get funding to do that, because we were turned down from our last grant proposal. So that would be the solution. It would tell you immediately just how much methane there is waiting to come out. It might be a smaller quantity, or it might be a bigger quantity, but you have to go there, and it's hard to get funds to do field work these days.
I did read that in 2012, some folks were up there, like Natalia Shakova.
Yes.
And they had some findings, but I wanted to ask you, first of all, why was it important to go there?
Yes, well, the East Siberian Shelf they went to because that's where methane bubbles and methane emissions had first been seen. And so they were able to go there actually via a joint program with National Science Foundation. It's a very sensitive area because it's Russian territorial waters, and the Russians don't like people coming in to study climate change, because Putin would rather there wasn't any climate change, so he could keep selling gas and oil. So they're having to battle the system, and they managed it by using a Russian ship to do the work, but it was paid for by National Science Foundation via a grant, University of Alaska. So that was a kind of fragile arrangement that has now ended. And so this next one would be the European Union, if they'd supported it. But since then, people have been to other coastal seas, of the Laptev Sea, the Kara Sea, and there's been at least two expeditions, one Swedish and one Norwegian, which have detected big methane plumes, one in the Kara Sea, for instance. So it looks as if all the shallow seas, where the water depth is only about 100 metres, all those shallow seas north of Siberia are having these methane emissions. So it's not. So Shakova based her estimates on the East Siberian Sea alone, but you need to multiply that by about four to include all the other coastal seas. Right. What's holding everything back is a layer of permafrost on the seabed that dates back to the last ice age. And it didn't melt after the ice age, because there was still sea ice in the water column, and so that you never had the water rising above freezing point. But now it does, and you have warmer water in the summer, and so the amount of heat that's brought in depends on the pattern of ocean currents, and the permafrost is sitting there preventing the methane from getting out. Once the pressure's removed, the methane is contained in methane hydrates, which is a solid material with methane molecules inside ice. But that is unstable under conditions of lower pressure. So as soon as you take away that pressure cooker cap, the sediments disintegrate, the methane hydrates disintegrate to produce pure methane, which comes out. And it comes out preferentially through various fissures and faults in the seabed called tarlicks, sort of faults running down into the seabed, which provide an easy route for the methane to get out.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask you about blue water event. How close do you think, Professor Wadhams, how close do you think we are to experiencing one now in the Arctic?
Well, it could still happen this year, but it's unlikely. There's still quite a lot of ice left.
So we're that close?
Yeah, we're pretty close. I mean, the way things seem to be developing is everybody was always looking at September to say that a blue water event is when the ice in September goes. And that was kind of dropping down towards zero, but didn't quite reach zero. So it's still hovering around. But if you look at the rest of the year, people weren't looking at that. But all the other months of the year, the area of ice is much lower than it's ever been before. So we're getting an absolute minimum of ice area right through the winter, spring. It's just holding out in the summer to avoid going to zero. So it may be that when we get a blue water event, when we look round at the rest of the year, we see that the rest of the year the ice is way back from where it used to be, and that's having a bigger effect average through the year than just a disappearance in September.
Does the duration of the BWE matter?
Yes, the duration's important. And what's likely is that if you get a blue water event just for a month or so, then the following year it'll be longer because it's absorbing much more radiation during the summer months. I mean, we found something like this in 2015. We were up in the Beaufort Sea in a ship called the Sikuliak, and we went in October and November to catch the beginning of the autumn or the fall advance of the sea ice. And we found the sea ice wasn't advancing. It would start advancing, and storm would come up, and the storm would bring up heat from the water column and cause the new ice to melt and go back again. So the ice edge, which should have been inexorably advancing towards Bering Strait and then down through Bering Strait, just was sitting there hovering, advancing and retreating. And as a result, the whole of the subsequent winter had a lower ice cover than we've had before. So that's the effect of summer heat in the water column preventing or delaying new ice formation. So that would happen with a blue water event. The extra heat absorbed in the water column would then slow down the advance of ice the following autumn and would then ensure that there was another blue water event the following summer.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. It would become a regular feature now. Forgive the blunt question, but is that the end of us? I mean, a blue water event, is that us done? Is that the final toll of the bell?
Well, yes and no. I mean, no, not immediately. In the past, people just thought, well, ice disappears, so what? It's a bit like the glaciers on Kilimanjaro disappear, oh, so what? But it's actually the fact that the disappearance of ice has all these other feedbacks which are actually more serious than the loss of the ice itself. So the event, the blue water event, will simply accelerate all these other feedbacks, and it's the other feedbacks which are having a bigger impact on climate. So it's simply accelerating the warming of the planet and all the effects arising from that, which include these weather events as well that we're getting, which are having a very large impact. So it's not the end, but it's sort of on the way to the end if we don't really do something very, very seriously.
Could you make comments about the political angle of this and why that kind of muddles everything up?
Yes, well, a lot of things make me very angry, so I I couldn't resist including some of them in the book. My previous books have been textbooks, so I started out really saying what ICE is, what it does, and that first part you might have found pretty boring. And then I got on to what it does to the climate, and that the climate effect is so serious that I felt that was the main part of the book, was the climate impact of the ICE retreat. But then what really made me angry was the fact that for a long time, the data was being ignored. You'd have the data, it would be showing what's going on, extrapolating, it would be telling what's going to be happening in the future, which is very serious, things have to be done. And then you'd encounter some daft politician, or not daft, actually, somebody with an axe to grind, or some sort of dirty dealings in the background that's where he's making money out of climate change. And those people have a responsibility which they don't discharge. They have a responsibility to look at what's going on, to take note of it, and to do something about it on behalf of the human race. And they can't be bothered. They'd much rather feather their own nests and hope that nothing happens while they're in Parliament. And so it applies, of course, in the US with knobs on with Trump, but it applies in the UK as well. And so I was giving some UK examples.
Yeah, well, that type of hot air seems just as dangerous as the real hot air.
Yes. I try and make a positive point at the end to say, despite all this ignorant politicians, we can save ourselves if we can really devote huge resources, the resources that are needed, to taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, finding an economic way to do that. Then we've got it problem beaten, because it's CO2 is the main villain. If we go the way we're going, we've had it. And even if we try and follow the Paris Agreement and reduce carbon emissions, we've still had it, because we won't be reducing them fast enough. And even so, it's sort of too late, because carbon dioxide has such a long persistence. But the only way we can save ourselves is to actually remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. We can try these geoengineering methods that put a kind of sticking plaster on warming. But in the long run, we've got to get the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere faster than we're putting it in. And that's a very, very expensive business. It will be the biggest effort that the human race is making. We need to do it to save ourselves. If an asteroid was heading for the Earth, then people would deploy every possible thing, that the massive costs will be incurred to save the planet. People would be aware that you have to get rid of this asteroid to save the world. Well, we have to get rid of carbon dioxide to save the planet. We have to wake up to the fact that that's what the human race has got to do.
It seems like we haven't really thrown any money at this problem yet. Is that a fair assumption?
Yes, it is. I mean, Guy McPherson, I agree with his diagnosis of what's happening to the planet, but I'd like to disagree with his despair, where he says we can't do anything, we're doomed. My feeling is, well, if we keep on in the way we're going, we're doomed.
But he's right. Things,
The two things ultimately is CO2 drawdown, getting CO2 out of the atmosphere. That's a major thing. But in the meantime, I think geoengineering can keep the warming rate down. It doesn't do anything about carbon dioxide, but it can keep the warming rate down. And methods already exist that can do it. I mean, I've been working with a group that has a wonderful system. That's marine cloud brightening, which they developed by Stephen Salter, who's a very brilliant engineer who used to work on wave power machines. And it's from a drone ship injecting fine particles of water through a tower into the bottoms of stratus clouds of a size that when they move into the cloud, they make the cloud brighter. So you're brightening up all those grey clouds that you get all over the world. And the calculations are that it would be enough to actually prevent warming, I mean, stop warming in its tracks, as long as you keep having several hundred of these ships cruising around doing this. So we can hold back global warming with marine cloud lightning. He's got a blueprint for the ships and the whole system, and the first tests would only cost about £70 million, he estimates. That sounds a lot, but it's tiny.
No, everything.
And yet they can't get funding from the British government, even though the British government's supposed to be the greenest government we've ever had. But when it comes to spending anything other than trivial amounts of money, they won't do it. So that's very dispiriting.
Do you have any relationship with Theresa May, the Prime Minister, as far as does she listen to you or get in contact with you about the situation?
I have never, ever talked to her, sadly. I think she's much more concerned with, well, two things. One is staying Prime Minister. Sure. Second is Brexit. Yeah. But I had a very nice, good thing going with Margaret Thatcher. Yeah, she came and visited my lab, and she wanted me to write a speech for the UN. She's a chemist by trade, so she knew. She's the first and only scientist ever to be Prime Minister. She was told about global warming. She learned how the process works. She realized how important it was. She was trying to do something about it, get countries to agree. And then she got kicked out of office for a completely unrelated reason to doing with taxes. From then on, no British Prime Minister has had a clue. None of them have done anything significant. And the same applies really across the world. Right. She was ruthless enough to go around bashing people with her handbag. And if she'd have stayed on, she could have made something happen on a global scale.
But and she was conservative too, and she was...
Oh, yes, God, yes.
I mean, that's ironic.
Good friends with Reagan, yeah.
Well, she was a Tory, but she was a scientist as well. You see, she actually understood the problem. So it wasn't a party political problem in those days. Now it is. You know, if you're conservative, you mustn't believe in climate change. If you want to be a Republican candidate for president, you have to pretend it's a hoax. In those days, it wasn't political. Everybody accepted it was happening and it was a serious problem.
Going back to the BWE, the Blue Water event, are you saying that we're likely to experience in the short term a release of about 8% of the methane stored? And what would that do to the average temperature in your...
Well, we did some climate modeling on it. If you release 8% of the methane, it will raise global temperatures by 0.6 of a degree within about 5 years. And that's a big chunk. I mean, that's... We've only had about a degree of warming since the 19th century. So 0.6 of a degree is a big leap in a short time. The fears are that we'll get maybe 4 degrees of warming by the end of the century, which would be a disaster. The hope is to only have 2 degrees, but this is 0.6 of a degree, more or less instantaneously.
Yeah, yeah. The concern, I think, what it might do to the... grain-producing areas.
Well, that's this thing about weather events. We've only been having these extreme weather events for about the last 10 years. And if you look back, 2006, I think, was the first year in which we really had a very big retreat of Arctic sea ice. So what's happening is that the Arctic's warming up much more now in the summer, in fact, in all times of the year. And the temperature difference between Arctic air and tropical air is reducing, and that reduction weakens the jet stream, which is the boundary between them, and that weaker jet stream takes on these big lobes, and these lobes allow cold air to come down from the Arctic to places it shouldn't be in, and allows hot air from the tropics to go up to places. And the trouble is, the places they get to are the mid-latitudes. The cold air comes down to mid-latitudes, the hot air goes up to mid-latitudes, and mid-latitudes is where you're growing all the crops. So most of the world's crops are grown in mid-northern latitudes, and that's going to have a major impact on crop production just at a time when the population's exploding. So that effect is going to be disastrous, and think in the sense that it's going, the first deaths directly attributable to climate change are going to be starvation from food production not keeping pace with population rise. These lobes move very slowly, and the bigger the lobes, the more slowly they move. The driving force, the temperature difference, is lower, and those slow movements look to the people as if they're there forever. You have a heat wave that lasts for two or three months, is really a slowly moving mass of air in a lobe of the jet stream.
And wouldn't that in turn increase the risk of fire?
Oh, yes. Well, of course, I just come back from California as the visiting Scripps, and lots of fires, more fires than last year. And you always wonder, will I be able to get to the airport, or will there be a fire in between me and the airport?
We're releasing all kinds of carbon with those fires, but at the same time, there's a certain amount of shielding, that's solar shielding that's occurring, right?
Yes. I mean, you see the smoke from the fires is detectable across the whole of North America.
Is it possible for the jet stream itself to just disappear? I mean, once the temperatures align?
I don't know whether that's been modeled, but it would. I mean, the jet stream is a boundary flow, and you don't have a boundary flow if you've got no boundary, if the polar air and the tropical air are very similar in temperature. You'll get some completely different system setting up, which and the consequences are just ones I wouldn't dare to say what they might be.
Professor Williams, what can we do as individuals?
Well, it's difficult. There was I'm not sure if it was a cynical remark, but it sounded cynical, by a British science advisor, said that if we all did a little, the result would be a little. when you said, what can we do as individuals, then one does say, well, nothing much. You can try and whatever you do with recycling and riding bicycles and so on is trivial as far as the world's concerned. But what we can do as individuals is through the democratic process, where it still exists, press governments to do the serious kind of Manhattan Project type research that we need to get both geoengineering going and carbon removal going. If we can do that via pressing the government to say, look, this is really serious, you have to do something about it, then we're doing our job as individuals.
That was Dr. Peter Wadhams, the UK's most experienced sea ice scientist. He was Professor of Ocean Physics at Cambridge from 1992 to 2015. With increasing urgency, Wadhams is calling attention to the disappearing sea ice off the Arctic. In his most recent book, A Farewell to Ice, he writes, "Our planet has changed color. Today, from space, the top of the world in the northern summer looks blue instead of white. We have created an ocean where there was once an ice sheet." End quote. The excerpts you heard are from the Reality Report blog, produced by Paul McGinley and Brian Weinstein, and you can watch the whole conversation on YouTube. They interviewed Professor Peter Wadhams on August 22, 2018. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.